we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover as usual, starting with local and our governor's State of the State speech.
Yeah, this week, Governor Gregoire gave her State of the State address. And every year, the governor gives an address similar to the president's State of the Union address. But the governor uses her address to try to tell the legislature what she thinks they ought to do in the coming session. And Governor Gregoire, of course, asked for five things. The first thing that she asked for was that the legislature pass her budget of all cuts. And, you know, she spent some time talking about how the state is its workers, and its workers need great training. And
all six of them that are left after this budget.
Yeah, and education is important, and so on and so on. And then she urged the legislature to pass her budget that includes huge and very deep cuts to basic education, not just to higher education. There are cuts for higher education in there, too, but cuts to K through 12 education. And then, of course, she turned right around and she said, well, at the very end of that, she said that we need to raise revenue in order to buy back some of those education, if not all of those education cuts. And she pushed for her half-cent sales tax increase. But she didn't immediately mention the half-cent sales tax increase. She had a sentence in there about other ways to raise revenue. And I'm going to read that sentence to you. It's, close tax loopholes to save vital services like the basic health program for the working poor. So she doesn't say close tax loopholes to balance the budget, because the legislature could do that. They could close enough tax loopholes to make up the entire budget deficit if they wanted to. She says close tax loopholes to save the basic health program.
I would add into that, there has been absolutely nothing to prevent Gregoire from advocating for the closing of tax loopholes for the past 7 years.
Exactly.
It's not like this is a new phenomenon.
Exactly. And she doesn't, and that's the only sentence she mentions about any other revenue source besides the half-cent sales tax increase. She doesn't mention what tax loopholes are out there. She doesn't say, for example, we could get rid of this tax loophole or that tax loophole. She just makes the one sentence comment, close a few little, you know, loopholes to save the basic health plan.
Unlike the sales tax increase, and unlike the proposed budget, she is advancing no specific proposals to the legislature which would actually close any tax loopholes.
No.
She's leaving that to the legislature.
She doesn't say, I have a bill.
Yeah, she's leaving that to the legislature to take on its own if it wants to. And this gets back to a theme we've talked about on this program quite a bit. We talked last week about Gregoire suddenly finding a spine. Well, it seems to have gone away again. It was one of those one of those things that dissolves after, maybe like a sand painting or something, where it goes away after a while.
She learned that from Gary Locke, I think.
Or one of those temporary tattoos you can get. The kids get.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. I like that.
Yeah. Or henna washes out of your hair eventually. All right. You know, it's not as if there aren't other alternatives out there. Of course, she also doesn't mention a state income tax, and she doesn't mention the, for example, I-511, which I think initiative supporters proposed in December, you know, and I think they know that they didn't have the time to gather enough signatures for I-511 to go to the ballot. That I-511, of course, was the income tax, the excise. It was called an excise tax, which is basically the same as an income tax on people who make more than $1 million in the state of Washington. And I think they proposed it thinking that if we propose this, someone in the legislature will bring it forward as a bill. Maybe even the governor will say something about it. Well, of course, she didn't. She didn't at all. She should have said, at least put forward an alternative plan in case the legislature couldn't agree to take a sales tax to the voters. Because, of course, since Tim Eymann's initiative passed last year, the legislature can't pass a tax increase unless they have a two-thirds majority. So also in her speech, which I thought was interesting, there was a lot of corporate butt-kissing. She mentions Boeing at least five times,
In the context of tax loopholes?
No, it was not in the context of tax loopholes. It was in the context of we should be proud of these things, you know, and she mentions all our great corporate citizens, but not very much about average citizens in the state of Washington. She mentions Boeing at least five times, even though it's not a Washington corporation anymore. And, of course, she mentions all the usual suspects, Microsoft at least twice in her speech, Starbucks, Amazon, Nordstrom, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. She goes on to mention Bill Gates another one or two times as well. And I just, as reading that, I was just kind of thinking, I hope she's getting paid for all this advertising that she's doing for these guys. But, of course, you know, she's not.
It's going to be very interesting to see once Gregoire retires as governor. Uh-huh. If she does not get
a lobbying job,
if she doesn't get a job in the Obama administration's second term, which is a possibility. I mean, if they hire Gary Locke, they'd hire anybody. But if she gets her lobbying job, who her clients are going to be,
yeah,
and how well they line up with those tax loopholes that she's not making any specific proposals for.
Exactly, exactly. And then she went on to ask for, the third thing that she asked for was the legislature to pass her school reforms. And her school reforms, and I think this was in response to the recent Supreme Court decision, the state Supreme Court decision saying that the state is not funding a basic education for its students the way the Constitution, the state Constitution requires it to. Her school reforms are very vague. She asks public universities, which I should point out because of major budget cuts are becoming more and more like private universities soliciting funds from major donors like, Bill and Melinda Gates and Starbucks and so forth. She asked public universities to partner with low-performing schools and then gives no details of what she thinks they ought to do. And then she points out, well, we are going to open an Office of Student Achievement to, quote-unquote, fix the gaps from high school through college, with, of course, no mention of what those gaps are and what the Office of Student Achievement will actually do, other than maybe suck up some more state funding that the state doesn't
and
have.
And that was actually the only piece of her proposals that actually involved spending money, which raises the question.
Not the only piece. There's another piece in there about spending money, but go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead.
And her
talk about the other piece of spending money on education, I mean.
No, not on education. Yeah.
No, that's what I meant. Mm-hmm. That's the only piece I'm talking about, spending money on education, mm-hmm. whereas she's also proposing an all-cuts budget, which cuts quite a bit of money from education. And the problem with education in Washington State right now isn't that there's a gap between high school and college performance, because let's face it, most high school students in the state of Washington right now can't afford to go to college.
Exactly.
The problem is that there's not enough resources in the classroom, and there's not enough money going into teachers, teacher training, schoolroom supplies, the basics of education in order to give a quality education. It's money that is the issue, and she's not providing a solution for that.
That's right. And then she goes on in her state of the state address to ask for a fourth item, and that's more spending by the state legislature, but not for education. It's her transportation package, which, of course, she had to sell as a jobs package as well. And I want to point out that she convened a task force the middle of last year called the Connecting Washington Task Force in order to come up with a list of projects, transportation projects, that needed immediate addressing in order to get an idea of what the most important maintenance projects for Washington's transportation system are. And that task force, the Connecting Washington Task Force, came up with a $21 billion list of projects that they considered a minimum number that needed to be spent, $21 billion, in order to get Washington's transportation infrastructure up to snuff. And so what does Gregoire do? She doesn't propose a $21 billion package. That's way beyond what the state can afford right now. She proposes a $3.6 billion 10-year maintenance package for roads, bridges, ferries, and transit, about one-sixth of the minimum that's needed. And how is she proposing to fund it? Well, she's asking the legislature to pass a $1.50 per barrel fee, not a tax. She called it a fee, even though it really is a tax, on every barrel of oil produced in Washington. I think she means every barrel of oil that's refined in Washington, plus a few other small fee increases that she doesn't mention and doesn't specify. Now, there are some big problems with that. The main problem with that is that it's a fixed fee that doesn't adjust for inflation. Just like the gas tax, it's a fixed fee that doesn't adjust for inflation. So the value of that tax in real dollars is going to decline over time, just as the gas tax does. But it will also suffer from the other thing that the gas tax has suffered from. The gas tax, of course, is supposed to go for road maintenance projects, and the gas tax isn't doing its job, so she has to propose this other fee that will have the same problem. The other problem is that oil consumption on the whole is going down nationally and regionally for a couple of reasons. Because of the economy, people are driving less and spending less money on transportation, and people are also driving more fuel efficient cars. So you can expect that $1.50 barrel of oil fee to not bring in the amount of funds she's projecting it will bring in over time.
And you also want, as a matter of social policy, to encourage people to drive less, so you don't want to have a state policy that's dependent on encouraging people to drive more.
Yeah. So in her State of the State address, she asks for one last thing right near the end. She says, and I'm going to read the sentence, Our Washington has always fought discrimination. It is time to do it again. It is time for marriage equality. And I'm like, whoa, wait, I almost got whiplash there. Because, you know, earlier on in the speech, she mentions that the single most important export for the state of Washington, the thing that has helped keep Washington from sinking lower in the economic downturn, is its exports. And the most important export in the state of Washington is its agricultural products. And this year has been the worst year ever for growers to try to find enough help to help them bring that harvest to market. And it's because of the nation and the state's terrible immigration policies. And for just a second there, I thought maybe she was going to say something about immigration. But no, she took the easy way out and she talked about marriage equality.
Well, it might be easy for, say, you or I. But bear in mind that she hasn't been saying anything on marriage equality for
True.
7 years. This is a leap for her. You know, Ed Murray, the senator from Seattle, has been introducing a marriage equality bill in the state Senate for years now. And Gregoire has not supported that bill until this year. So it actually is a leap for her. And I'm not sure whether we should give her credit for supporting it at this point or not so much give her credit because she's very, very late on that bus.
Yeah, she's so, and I think that was the plan, to do it in the last year of her governorship, so that she could say, I made an effort, but it wasn't a strong enough effort for anything to actually really get passed or have a chance in I don't know if I can say that, a chance in hell of getting passed in the legislature.
Oh, you can say it. Chance in hell.
And speaking of chance in hell of it getting passed in the legislature, this week before a bill was even proposed for to support gay marriage in the legislature, an Everett attorney named Steve Pidgeon filed an initiative to reaffirm the state's Defense of Marriage Act that was passed in 1998, and he's hoping that this will forestall any bill that's passed by the legislature in support of gay marriage.
Now it's very, very likely, as you would expect, that if a gay marriage bill does pass the legislature, that there will be some sort of an effort to turn it into a referendum and put it on the ballot. The question is, who's going to put it on the ballot? And one of the things that we saw, you know, a few years ago with the civil unions legislation was that it matters which right-wing wingnut actually jumps in first and tries to organize this effort. And the nice thing about this particular effort is that this guy is not well connected. He's a good friend of Orly Tate's, who's a birther, a very prominent birther from the state of California.
For people who don't remember what birther is, those are the folks who want to try to prove that President Obama wasn't born in the United States.
Or folks who've just, you know, blocked it out of their memory as something traumatic and yucky and, you know, sort of like when you have, yeah, never mind. But, you know, the thing is, this guy is way out on the political spectrum. He is not well connected with the state's evangelical movement. He's not well connected like say Ken Hutcherson or some of these other people.
Or Tim Lyman, who can
you know, who have experience and the resources to mount a statewide signature gathering campaign. So the fact that this guy is out in front and trying to co-opt this movement is actually probably a good thing, because he probably doesn't have the resources to do it well.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about locally, Education Week magazine, we're going to talk a little bit about the education funding problem again. Education Week magazine ranked the states in the United States according to their funding for education. Now, where did the state of Washington fall on this list? Well, we are 42nd in per pupil spending out of 50 states. We are 44th in expenditures as a percentage of taxable resources. And overall, in terms of education spending, Washington got an F grade from Education Week. Now, like I mentioned before, this comes after the state Supreme Court ruled that Washington's not meeting its constitutional obligations in terms of education funding.
And Washington State is one of the only states in the country that has a constitutional provision obligating it to adequately fund education. And we're still near the bottom in education spending.
Yeah. And so when you have 43 other states in the union who are doing a better job than you, you should take this as a warning that it's time to do something to raise more revenue, and that's not what our governor is doing.
All right. Moving on, developments in the race in the 1st District.
Yeah, the newly created 1st District in the state of Washington, the congressional district that used to be Jay Inslee's district but has been substantially redefined to go from everywhere from the northern part of the east side around Kirkland and Woodinville and that area, all the way up to the Canadian border in Whatcom County. Darcy, and the Democratic side, Darcy Berner has been in that race, Representative Roger Goodman, State Senator Steve Hobbs, several other people. Susan DelBonnet, who ran against Dave Reichert in 2010, has now joined that race this week as well. There are now a total of 6 Democrats in that race, 2 Republicans, and there's another independent who ran against Inslee in 2010 as a Republican who's expected to join that race this week. So far, 9 people competing for that top 2 primary in August.
Getting kind of crowded
a very, very crowded race. 6 of them are Democrats, so there's a real risk that even though it's a Democratic-leaning district, it is not a heavily Democratic-leaning district, that a number of those Democrats could cancel each other out and maybe even leave a possibility of 2 Republicans getting in. Now, the reason it's such a crowded district in the first place, it's a very oddly configured district. It avoids most of the population centers of Snohomish County and Everett and Mount Vernon and most of Bellingham City. But the way that the redistricting was set up this year by the commission that gave its findings to the state legislature a couple of weeks ago is to essentially strengthen the incumbents who are in place now, both Democratic incumbents such as Adam Smith and Republican incumbents such as Dave Reichert. And the way they did this was by putting all of the swing elements of the district into this one oddly configured district that they knew was going to be an open seat in 2012 because Jay Inslee is running for the governorship. So you have all of these people who've run for Congress before in 3 different districts against Rick Larson, against Jay Inslee, and against Dave Reichert, all being dumped into this one district, and the result is going to be a very crowded and probably a very expensive race for Congress this year.
How very convenient for Jay Inslee and Adam Smith and all these.
Well, Inslee's running for governor, but uh-huh. Yeah, but certainly for Dave Reichert, who got a much more conservative district that goes all the way over into Kittitas County on the east side of the mountains.
And he's had some serious opposition in the last
couple of
elections.
He's had some very serious opposition. Rick Larson has had some very serious opposition. He got a more Democratic district that's more centered on Everett, mm-hmm. and this one other district is now much more unpredictable.
Interesting.
All right. Got about 10 minutes left. Moving on to national, starting with a study out about marijuana.
Yeah, a study by UC San Francisco and the University of Alabama at Birmingham shows that light marijuana use doesn't harm lung function the way that cigarette smoking does. They studied 5,115 adults from age 18 to age 30 over the course of about 20 years. Some of those folks smoked marijuana, some smoked cigarettes, and some did both. They compared the 3 groups, and on average, they found that cigarette smokers smoke about 9 cigarettes per day, and that marijuana smokers, on average, smoke one or two joints a few times a month, certainly not daily. They found that the average smoker smoked occasionally, but not daily, although they had some participants in the study who were daily smokers, but not what you would consider heavy smokers. And now I kind of want to talk for a minute about why that is, that among a random sampling of younger adults, they found that when you start smoking cigarettes, you don't smoke a cigarette, you know, a few times a month. You don't smoke one cigarette a day. You smoke 9 cigarettes a day on average.
Or more.
And some people
more. And that's actually gone down from what it was, say, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and some people much more. And that's because big tobacco corporations put chemicals into cigarettes in order to make them more addictive, so that you don't want just one every couple of days. You want one every hour or more. So that's something that to note here about the difference between smoking cigarettes and smoking marijuana. The other thing is that when they studied the lung functions of people who smoked cigarettes, they found that during the study, cigarette smokers' lung functions worsened steadily. They didn't just stay the same. They didn't just get worse and then improve as their smoking habits changed. They worsened steadily. Pot smokers, on the other hand, if you smoked up to one joint a day for 7 years, showed no worsening of their lung function, which I found to be very, very interesting.
But I'll bet if they smoked 9 or 10 a day, they would.
Well, yeah, but nobody really wants or needs to smoke 9 or 10.
Let's hope not.
10 joints a day. And they found also for folks who smoked up to 20 years, one joint a week didn't affect your lung function. So I think that's that should be a sign that maybe we ought to consider marijuana use as not an illegal activity.
Moving on, greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, the EPA this week released its computerized map of the largest greenhouse gas emitters in the United States. And I'm going to give you the URL so you can go online and find that. You can type in epa.gov/climate change/emissions/GHG data. Or you can bring up the map where you type in your state and get the state emitters by typing in just ghgdata.epa.gov, GHG standing for greenhouse gas, so ghgdata.epa.gov. What I found interesting were two facts. The three largest single sources in the United States are two power generators in Georgia and one in Alabama, and all three of those are owned by a single company, the Southern Company, based in Atlanta. Clearly, power generating stations, particularly the ones that burn coal, are where we should be focusing if we want to lower our greenhouse gas emissions. Here in the state of Washington, of the biggest emitters, the biggest single emitter by far is the Centralia coal-fired generating station. But also on that in that top list are the four biggest oil refineries in the state of Washington. So transportation generates a lot of greenhouse gases, not just out of the tailpipe of your car or your truck, but also in the refining of oil.
Yeah. And while we talk about climate change on this program, well, pretty much every week, one or another aspect of it, that we don't share that in common with the network news. There was a study out this week by Climate Progress looking at 2011's evening network news coverage, that is CBS, NBC, ABC, of climate change, and found a total of 14 stories and 32 minutes for all three newscasts for all 365 days of the year. Now, that is the least amount of coverage since 2001 and only about a 12th as much coverage as in the peak year of 2007. There's literally more coverage of what's served for dinner in some diner in New Hampshire in the week of the primary election than there is on a threat that may literally wipe out civilization as we know it. It really does show you how sidelined climate change has become as a political and as a media issue in the United States in 2012, and that desperately has to change for us to have any chance of political change.
All right. On international, in Haiti.
Yeah, scientists verified this week that the cholera epidemic in Haiti, the extremely infectious and deadly cholera strain, was brought there by UN troops from Nepal, and that poor sanitary conditions, what they called the breakdown of sanitary conditions at the UN encampment next to the Artibonite River, was the cause of that cholera epidemic, and that it was particularly devastating because Haiti has never seen a case of cholera before. And so the people who fell ill were confused and didn't know what to do. They'd never seen this disease before at all. It was made it particularly devastating. And so they suggested that in the future, the UN do something to make sure that its troops maintain sanitary conditions when it's going into a country to try to help out after a natural disaster.
All right. And Iran.
Yeah, young Iranian nuclear scientist Muqtada Ahmadi Roshan was assassinated this week. Nobody nearly knows who by, but it is very conspicuous.
Oh, I think we know.
Very conspicuous in the U.S. media. The assumption being either some combination of Mossad and U.S. intelligence agencies, although you have some right-wingers floating the theory that Iran did it itself as a false flag operation so that it could blame the U.S., but I don't think very many people find that allegation credible.
Yeah, you can't argue that Iran is trying to develop a nuclear weapon and also trying to sabotage its own nuclear program at the same time.
Because
this is not the first nuclear person in the nuclear weapons program who's been assassinated.
No, there have been about a half dozen over the past 2 years. And these are acts of terrorism. These are acts that are designed to frighten other scientists in Iran from working on the nuclear program. And as such, they're both acts of war and violations of international law. But you won't find them being called acts of terrorism in the U.S. media. And the U.S. media's willingness or lack of willingness to embrace that term has been really quite disturbing. If you could imagine, for example, the shoe on the other foot and some Israeli scientists being assassinated in this matter, you know the terminology as well as the type of reaction by mainstream commentators in the U.S. would be very, very different than what we've seen this past week.
Yeah, speaking of the commentary in the mainstream press this week about Iran, one of the biggest news stories about Iran was the threat made by a minor Iranian official that Iran would close the Strait of Hormuz if the U.S. went forward with increased sanctions against Iran. And then, of course, it released this flurry of speculation in the mainstream press. Can Iran really close the Straits of Hormuz? And
here's a one-word answer. No.
No. Yeah. That's exactly right. They can't. And it led even to the point where you had the New York Times, the paper of record in the United States, printing a front page story about the threat from Iran closing off the 20% of the world's oil, which is shipped through the Strait of Hormuz. Well, that was the tone of the article, but you had to read almost to the end to get the actual facts that, in fact, the worst weapons that Iran can deploy in the Strait of Hormuz are a few mines and some Republican guards in speedboats. And while it's true that anyone can put a bomb into a speedboat and ram it into a ship, well, I wouldn't call that closing the Strait of Hormuz.
And it's not a sustainable strategy.
No, and it is not an effective military strategy.
All right. And finally, about a minute left to cover Pakistan.
Yeah. Speaking of front page articles in the New York Times, about a week ago, there was an article in the New York Times on the front page talking about how since drone strikes have stopped in Pakistan over the past couple of weeks, Al-Qaeda activity has increased. And sure enough, a couple of days later, drone strikes have resumed in Pakistan. And there was another front page article in the New York Times heralding that. This is a perfect example of domestic propaganda, the sort of thing that actually the Pentagon and the CIA are supposedly forbidden from doing. This was an article that was planted by the Pentagon to say, look, when we're not doing drone strikes, terrible things happen. This is why we need drone strikes and to sort of lay the groundwork for addressing any concerns when the drone strikes did resume. Very, very disturbing that the nation's most prominent newspaper is being used in this way when it's already gotten so much blowback for similar types of disinformation around Judith Miller and those types of things historically over the last decade and actually going back a lot further than that.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org with news, comments, comics, tips, all that kind of opinions, of course, all that kind of good stuff.
And I've also been posting some of my articles on my website, which is at mariatomczyk.com.